This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about mental health in the workplace. To start off with, I've got a few stats from our good friends over at the charity Mind. They found that a culture of fear and silence around mental health is costly to employers in the following ways. More than one in five, that's 21%, agreed that they had called in sick to avoid work when asked how workplace stress had affected them. 14% agreed they had resigned, and 42% had considered resigning when asked how workplace stress had affected them. So, Annie, what are your thoughts on those first two?
That doesn't surprise me at all, to be honest. Considering that one in four of us is affected by a mental health problem every year, I'm not surprised that one in five people have called in sick to avoid work on the grounds of mental health and stress. 14% agree that they had resigned and 42% considered resigning. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me in the slightest. I think everyone's got a story where they're like, I left this horrible, stressful job. I'd be surprised if somebody was like, yeah, I've never had a job that stressed me out so much that I changed my job.
Right. One thing I found particularly interesting, again, using that comparison from Mind, that one in four people will experience a mental illness. With the one where 42% had considered resigning when asked how workplace stress had affected them, if we compare those two, 42% is way above one in four. And so I wonder if maybe that is partly to do with the stigma. When asked about stress, a lot more people are like, oh yeah, I've been stressed. And that's something that we touch on a little bit in the interview as well, of how actually mental health is a spectrum, as we've talked about before, and we can all experience different levels on that spectrum, even if we're never as bad to be diagnosed with mental illness. And so I found that statistic particularly interesting. I think this is an important example of how actually we can all feel the symptoms at some point, even if we don't have the full-blown illnesses.
Sure, I agree. Like, that makes perfect sense to me. It's interesting how it always comes back to that one in four. Maybe mental health just really likes round numbers. I know that my mental health really likes round numbers.
I'm sure that's what it is.
Yeah, that's definitely what it is. Yeah, yeah.
You solved
mental
it.
Health itself has OCD and just loves things that fit in neatly with each other.
Sure. Let's stereotype OCD in our intro.
Well, that's how my OCD works. And because if it doesn't affect me, then of course it doesn't affect anyone else, because that's a classic way for people to now think on the internet. As I've been discovering today, lots of people are like, well, this doesn't affect me, so I don't want it. I'm like, oh, man. Did you see a thing on Twitter? I'm going to go on a massive tangent. There were some people protesting outside a Greggs the vegan sausage roll situation, and had blockaded a Greggs because they wanted to protest. There was so much police resources being used. And I think someone just captioned it like, these people who call you snowflakes are currently outside Greggs protesting a vegan sausage roll. I'm like, oh yeah, like the people that are super sensitive are those ones.
Bobby, check your story, but it was a pro-Brexit demonstration. But because it happened outside Greggs, and I don't know what was going on with that police force, but they obviously had some suspicions things were going to kick off. And so they pretty much cordoned off the demonstrators at one point, and that happened to be outside Greggs. When the photos hit the internet, people are like, they're protesting the vegan sausage roll. Why do they care?
I'm always happy to be corrected and fact-checked, so thank you.
But no, that did thoroughly entertain me, the fact that people got it so wrong, and then it went viral, and now the vegan sausage rolls are selling better than ever, so...
My boyfriend and I were walking around Brighton on Sunday, and there was, like, a huge queue inside the Greggs. But this is where I live in Brighton, so I was like, there's heaps of people looking for the vegan sausage roll down here. Maybe not so much, like, in other cities. All the Greggs in the city had like queues and queues and queues, so we didn't even get a look in.
I love that. I actually do want to try one, just because I'm curious.
Yeah, I just
and
yeah,
they probably are healthier, let's be honest.
I think they've got more protein as well.
I just remember how oily they are. Like, you don't want to squeeze too hard on a normal Greg sausage roll. Gently, like, just dangle it into your mouth or something.
You'll, like, squirt the lady on the train opposite you in the eye with some, like, pig fat. Just like, nah. Doing when people always say to me, oh, you're vegetarian or you're vegan. Like, where do you get your protein from? And I'm like, better, healthier protein sources than me.
And that's how the vegans are going to kill us all. They're going to get too strong and too big.
So ripped and so lean. Just crush everyone.
Oh, honey. All right. So,
back on topic.
Stats. What were we talking about? Mental health in the workplace.
And we were, weren't we? Shit.
Indeed, about 15 minutes ago. So, I think the final thing I wanted to say about these first statistics, again with the 42% had considered resigning when asked how workplace stress affected them, it's such a good example of how being able to better support the mental health of your employees is so vital to businesses across the board. Because if we're saying 1 in 4, then that means that some of those 42% are considering resigning from stress but haven't experienced mental illness. And so that's a perfect example of how it's far more broader than let us just look after the 1 in 4. It's actually how can we make this a better culture for everyone? How can we retain people? Because any company that has 42% of people considering leaving at some point is in big trouble.
I was making lots of supportive I'm listening noises, but I had myself on mute because I was also having a little biscuit at the same time. Yeah, I think that's so important. I'm just having a look at the stats myself. It says 56% of employers said they want to do more to improve staff well-being, but they don't have the right training or guidance, which is why it's so wonderful the work that our guest this week is doing. Like, it's precisely what he's doing, is training more people to improve mental health conditions in the workplace.
I take that as a really positive sign that more than half of employers surveyed by Mind said that they would want to do more. I think that's a sign that we're definitely moving in the right direction. The education and the understanding will catch up. And so finally, in case workplaces aren't convinced enough that this is a problem that needs addressing, the Mental Health Foundation reported 70 million workdays are lost each year due to mental health problems in the UK, costing employers approximately 2.4 billion per year. So basically, what we're saying is if you want to cut costs in your business, look after your staff better, listen to them without judgment, have a list of resources somewhere on your laptop as a manager where you can refer people if they tell you about mental illness. As we discussed with the guest as well, at the end of the episode, sometimes it is such small things that can really set somebody on the road to recovery. So I'm really excited to have David Beeney on as a guest. He now runs an organisation going around workplaces, teaching them how to better deal with mental illness and encourage mental health across all their employees. He's also a qualified counsellor, so he's super insightful. One more thing to mention before we get into the episode is that this is actually a two-part series all about mental health in the workplace, as it's so important and so timely with many people just starting back after the Christmas period. And I'm really delighted to be able to devote two episodes with two different guests to this, and look forward to you hearing not only this week's episode, but also the one that will come out next Thursday. With all that said, we'll get into the episode in just a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, my name's David Beeney. I always start by talking about the 2nd of September 1986, and I describe it as one of the worst days in my life. Whenever I say that, I feel guilty, because nobody died close to me, and in reality, I'll have worse days than that day. But let me tell you why I describe that as one of the worst days in my life. I was 24 years old, and I'd just been promoted to the job of a sales trainer. And on the very first day of my new job, my boss said to me, would I mind just going into an interview to talk about the company's training for new starters, just for 4 or 5 minutes? And I remember that conversation because I was really excited by it. I felt my career was really taking off. I just got this new promotion to be a trainer, and now I'm getting involved with interviewing people for the first time. So I go into this interview room. It's quite a small room, And the guy we're interviewing is quite a big guy, and he's probably twice my age. And I think as I went into the room, from memory, he gave me a look like, who's this little kid? What does he know? And perhaps that undermined me, I don't know. But anyway, it got to my big moment. My boss turned to me and said, over to you, David. Do you want to talk about the company's training for 4 or 5 minutes? So I started speaking, and straight away, my voice was very shaky. And the more I spoke, the shakier it became. And I realized that I was struggling with my breathing. And it was like I had a little voice in my head that was saying to me, what would happen if your breathing got that difficult that you couldn't speak? And that's exactly what happened. About 30 or 40 seconds later, I literally couldn't get another word out, another sentence out. It's probably the only time in my life I thought about pretending to faint, because I was so humiliated. I was so embarrassed. There's only two people in the room. I only had to speak for a few minutes, and yet I couldn't get another word out. So I put my head in my hands, and my boss said to me, are you okay? And I said, no. And she said to me, look, don't worry about the rest of the interview. I'll finish it off. So I went and sat in the room opposite. I just couldn't work out what happened to me. I didn't understand. I was a confident young guy, and this had never happened to me before. Eventually, my boss appeared, and she came in with a big smile on her face and said, David, whatever happened in there this morning, just forget all about it. And she said to me, the good news is we've got another interview this time tomorrow. And I remember thinking, no, that's the worst thing I wanted to hear. We talk about having sleepless nights, but I really didn't sleep that night at all. I kept thinking, what's going to happen if it happens again tomorrow? I went to work the next day and I put the mask on. Not a real mask, but a mask of a smiley face that says everything's okay in my world. But I was dreading 11 o'clock coming round. 11 o'clock comes round. We're going to the same interview room. And this time it's a young lady and we're interviewing. And I remember she gave me a really big smile. And for just a moment, I thought, what was I worried about? Today feels really different. Well, it wasn't different at all. I didn't even get as far as I'd got the previous day before I was completely breathless. And again, I put my head in my hands, and again, my boss asked me to leave that interview. And if I was worried yesterday, I now completely catastrophize the situation. I walked out that interview and I thought to myself, why don't I keep on walking? There's no way they're going to keep me on in my job if I can't speak to two people for a few minutes. So I might as well leave. I thought, I'm 24 years old, I'll just get another job. And then I thought to myself, but how am I going to get another job? Because when you go for interviews, they ask you to talk about yourself. And if I can't even talk about myself for a few minutes, I'm not going to get another job. And I was in a relationship where we were saving for our first house at the time. And I suddenly thought, if I can't contribute towards that relationship, I'm going to come under pressure in that relationship and I'm going to end up single. And then I thought, I'm never going to own a house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mental health is incredibly brittle. 2 days earlier, I'm really buzzing about my new job and really excited about, you know, interviewing people for the first time. And only 48 hours later, at 24 years old, my life is in complete crisis.
Just pause there. Then.
Yes, of course. Yes, of
so
course.
There's loads to pick up on there. Particularly, I love that point of how quickly it changed, because you've described as not having any experience of these kind of symptoms of panic attacks before, and then it's happened twice. And so typical for anxiety, your mind's going to all the worst places. Mm. You're not going to be able to pay the mortgage. You're going to lose your job. You can't sleep. Out of interest, when you couldn't sleep the previous night, what kind of things were going on in your head? What did you think was going to happen in the room?
Well, I kept thinking the same is going to happen again, because I wasn't worried about the first day. I was going in there quite looking forward to the experience of helping to interview this person. But I knew what was going to happen the following day. I knew there's no way I was going to get through it, because I didn't really calm down from the moment that interview finished. My thoughts became very negative, very dark, very black. And I just knew there was no way I was going to get through it. Even though it was a lovely young lady who was far more sort of relaxed and mm-hmm. the mood in the room was better. I sensed my boss was really trying to help me as well. I sensed she was trying to relax me, but it wasn't helping at all. Interestingly, you used the phrase, I'd had a panic attack. It wasn't for years later I realised that's what I had. Mm-hmm. I just thought, I've got a bit of a problem. And it's a bit weird. I don't want to talk about it to anybody. It's too embarrassing. Yeah, I didn't refer to it as a mental health issue or a panic attack for many, many years.
Right. And that's completely understandable, those initial responses where you didn't want to talk about it because you didn't know what was going on with yourself. And it's really tough to be that open and that vulnerable with someone, say, I'm struggling with something, I don't know what it is. And that's really common, I think, particularly in today's internet age. I don't know many people that go to the GP about something new without having not looked it up online. Mm. You know, we almost want to kind of have that armour of knowledge in every scenario.
Mm. It was only just over 2 years ago that I thought for the first time about the relationship between my career, for example, and my mental health. Mm-hmm. And I started to develop coping mechanisms, but the vast majority of them were subconscious. Amazingly, I didn't speak about those interviews for 36 years after they happened.
Wow.
Even my boss in those interviews, her little girl became bridesmaid at my wedding. So we became really good friends. But she never again ever asked me about what happened in those interviews, because that's what we do in mental health. We don't talk about it. I didn't talk about it with my parents who I lived with at the time. I didn't talk about it with my fiancée who became my wife for 28 years. In fact, we never ever spoke about it. I didn't chat about it with my mates down the pub even after 5-6 beers. The only person I spoke to all that time ago was my doctor. I did go and see a GP, and he did exactly what I feared. He sent me off to see some sort of psychiatrist that confirmed to me I was going bonkers. That whole experience was awful. I only went once, and I remember sitting there thinking, I'm not coming back here. I'm just going to have to deal with this, whatever this is, myself. And for the next 36 years, I completely suffered in silence. And nobody in my life, professionally, personally, nobody knew that I inside was suffering with panic and anxiety.
That's fascinating. And I wish that experience was more uncommon than it is.
Mm.
There's so many people, I feel like, particularly with men, we have this tendency to bottle these things up.
Unbelievably so. As you know, I do a lot of talks these days in the corporate world around mental health. And if I'm in a business where employees can come along and see me voluntarily about talk about this subject, and let's just say, for example, their gender mix is 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
On average, the turnout is 80% female and 20% male. We're all aware there's two statistics to do with men and mental health that won't go away. One is that nearly 8 out of 10 suicides are male. Nearly 8 out of 10. And just when you think there can't be a worse statistic for men, there is. And that's that if you're a man under 50 and you die before you're 50 years old, the most likely way you're going to die is taking your own life. More than cancer, more than a road traffic accident, because suicide is the biggest killer of men under 50.
Mm-hmm.
We condition males to think that it's weak to cry. It's not weak to cry. It's not weak to show your emotions, but we're conditioned from such an early age that we make it very difficult for men to be honest about how they're truly feeling about their emotions. Hopefully that's changing with education around mental health, but we've got a long way to go, I fear, a long way to go.
Right. They're good comparisons of things you mentioned there, like severe illnesses like cancer, like road traffic accidents, where there's something that we have an innate fear for. We know that they're out there and they could kill us. And yet, even now, though I know all the statistics on how bad suicide in men is, it can be difficult to properly internalise that. Because so often that's kind of hidden away and not talked about, whereas you're constantly seeing traffic accidents on the news. Mm. And I think until there's that disparity is dealt with, it's never going to be addressed seriously enough. But then on the flip side, I think there is still that fear that can come out. So if you start going through mental illness, even if you've never feared suicide, you start getting bad. And I think you can easily start to fear it. But the difference is it's a fear that we don't talk about.
It is a fear we don't talk about it. And as I've just said, the majority of my audiences are female. But I'm conscious of saying too much about this because there is equally many, many, many females who can't talk about their mental health either. I lost a very good friend this week last year. She was a trainer for Marks and Spencer's and a very good mental health counsellor. And I think it was this day a year ago, she sent me the last text I ever received from her, which was recommending that I watched a programme on suicide. And now, that didn't appear that unusual because she was a fellow mental health counsellor, so we might recommend a programme like that. But I will live for the rest of my life knowing that there was a clue there. There was a clue there. I know that. And I didn't spot it. And ironically, I watched the programme on iPlayer 5 days later. At the time, she was probably taking her own life. And it was... Yeah, I'm coming up to the anniversary of that, so that's quite tough to talk about, to be honest.
Yeah, it's incredibly tough, and it's really natural to feel guilty about that.
Mm.
But had she spoken to you about any kind of suicidal feelings previously?
Like so many people in Sue's situation, she was the life and soul of a party. She was always laughing and smiling and joking. And yes, I knew she had some troubles with anxiety because we'd shared that, you know, between ourselves. And yes, I can look back now and our relationship had drifted in the 6 months prior to that. So I wasn't particularly close to her in those 6 months. But I look back now and know the reason she was actually wasn't close to anybody. I presume her friendships had moved, but she was probably removing herself socially from lots of people during that period. And I obviously am annoyed at myself now that I didn't make a bigger effort to speak to her during that time, as opposed to just the occasional text and things like that. But yeah,
it's really tough. It's very tough. But we can all fall trap, I think, to these kind of stereotypes of, oh, the tough friend is the one that has it all together. Mm. But actually, it's often, I think, a learnt behaviour. I don't know many people that I consider really tough that haven't had to go through something to build up that skill.
We naturally check in with people who look down or look sad, and we really need to check in with everybody. It's just over 4 years since we lost, you know, one of the funniest comedians of all time, Robin Williams, who certainly used his humour to mask his dark, depressive side. I was delivering a talk in a business about 6 months ago now, and about half an hour before I was due to speak, a guy came in the room carrying his laptop, and he said to me, "I know you're not speaking for half an hour," he said, "but do you mind if I sit here and do some emails?" And he said to me, "I promise not to talk to you." He didn't shut up. For the next half an hour, he made me laugh. And as his colleagues came in near the start of my talk, he made them laugh too. So much so that one of his colleagues said to me that I should take him around the country with me as my warm-up act because he's a really funny guy. At the part of the talk where I was saying that it's often the happy, smiley people who are suffering, he broke down and started to cry. And it was a really, on one hand, it was an awkward moment because we all suddenly realised that the guy in the room who was laughing and joking and was the entertainer was actually the guy who was probably hiding the most stuff. And someone went over to him and gave him a really big hug, and it was a really lovely moment. But as I say, we all suddenly realised that the person at work who was the funniest guy in the office was actually the guy who was probably most likely suffering with his mental health. So we just can't tell who's suffering. It's invisible. It's 4 out of 10 suicides now. Closest family and friends have no idea there's anything wrong with that person at all.
Right.
So 40% of people manage to completely mask from the people closest to them how they're really feeling.
Absolutely. And it's one of the like weirdest things with mental health across the board, whatever your condition, that we learn this ability to hide things so well. And we can learn to fake a smile. We can learn to joke and pretend to be laughing on our darkest days. Mm. And it's a really weird, because it is a skill, but it's not a skill we want. It's not a skill that serves us. And so with your experience, it sounds like you've done a similar thing where you went through, you didn't really have insight initially on what was going on. And so you use these similar techniques to sort of keep your emotions in check and keep them almost kind of boxed in, it feels like.
Yeah, the strange thing when I look back is that my mental health actually took my career in the other direction. It really sort of helped launch my career, because just when I thought at 24 that my life was in crisis, when I look back, that's when my career took off. And it was largely due to me trying to hide my mental health. To try and make sense of that, I just got this job as a trainer. And back in the late 1980s, training was really boring. Mm-hmm. Someone would just talk at you hour after hour. And I knew I couldn't
Some
do that.
Some of it's still quite like that.
I know that. I know that. I knew I couldn't do that because I'd have a panic attack. Mm. So I designed all my training sessions to take the focus off myself. And I started sort of doing breakout groups and workshops and all that sort of stuff well before most people did that. I wasn't clever. I wasn't like a trainer ahead of my time. I was simply a guy with a mental health issue who was trying to hide it. Mm-hmm. But luckily for me, I ended up delivering a very engaging style of training that got me a reputation as a very good trainer that really was the springboard to my career. And when I went into people management as well, again, I wasn't a manager who sat there and bored people just listening to my own voice, because I couldn't do that for fear of a panic attack. So I made my team meetings and things very interactive. Again, looking back, that built me a reputation as a very good people manager, yet it was very much shaped and driven by me trying to hide my mental health. Mm-hmm. And I think there's many comedians out there, you know, the likes of the Ruby Waxes of the world and various people who have, their careers have come about because of masking what's really going on inside. You often try and overcompensate when you're feeling sad or anxious, And by overcompensating, it actually creates a personality. It might not be the real you, but it creates a quite an entertaining, engaging style of personality. Not in every case, but certainly in some cases.
That's absolutely what I was thinking as you described that, that you were overcompensating in your career. And it just so happened that you stumbled into a really great way of training. Actually for quite different reasons.
The iconic moment of my career, again, I didn't really think this through until a couple of years ago, was me trying to avoid a panic attack. I was at a conference with about 400 people, and the guy on the stage wanted one person to come out from the audience to summarise the key takeout of his talk. And to cut a long story short, it ended up being me.
Wow.
And it was the moment I dreaded in my entire life, the moment when in front of a huge audience that I was going to fall apart. So I walked towards the stage thinking, and I already couldn't breathe. I already thought, I've just had it. I'm not going to be able, I'm going to stand on that stage and I'm not going to be able to get a word out. And it's going to be the moment in my life I dreaded. And I quickly thought as I got near the stage, ignore the guy on the stage completely what he's asked you to do. Just do your out of your box idea. It sounds like I was being brave. I wasn't. I had no choice. I couldn't do what the guy on the stage wanted me to do. And because I always had to have escape routes or coping mechanisms in case of panic, I had something prepared if I had to do a 2-minute presentation at that conference. So this is what I did. I got onto the stage and I said to 400 people, I'm going to give you a choice. I was still nervous, by the way, but I wasn't in a state of panic. So I said to the audience, I'm going to give you a choice. First of all, I could give you the feedback that I've been asked to give you by the chairman of this company about his keynote speech and what his key takeout was. But I think you'd all agree it was a marvellous talk and you all know what the key takeout is. So that would be pretty boring, wouldn't it? Or I said, option two, I can get my balls out, which people tried not to laugh. Some people looked disapproving at me. And what nobody knew was that in my pockets, I had loads and loads of those super bouncy balls. So I bounced balls around the conference and I then held the ball in my hand and said, I want people to watch my hand really carefully and watch what this ball does. So I dropped this bouncy ball and I caught it. And I said to the audience, what did that ball just do? And someone shouted, it bounced back. And I said, just like you're going to do when you're having a bad day. And from somewhere I gave this talk about resilience and the importance in life of bouncing back, saying that we all have tough times, we all have tough days. And I advised everybody to carry a bouncy ball. And when you're having a crap day, you get your ball out, you bounce it, and you say to yourself, I'm going to bounce back like my ball. And I got this huge applause. Mm-hmm. And it became an iconic moment in my career because I was the guy who ignored the chairman of the company and in front of 400 people said, I'm going to get my balls out. So it really enhanced my career. But what nobody knew for 20 plus years after that, I was simply hiding a panic attack. I wasn't some creative genius who waited for this Andy Warhol moment to do something amazing. I was desperately fighting against a panic attack, and that was my escape. So again, it was an example of how my mental health was actually very positive in my career. Don't get me wrong, my mental health has held me back massively at the same time. So let's keep some perspective around it. I worked alongside people in my 20s and 30s now who are, they're retired, they've got so much money, they run big companies, they sit around boardroom tables. And I'm sitting here in Birmingham this afternoon chatting to you lot on a podcast.
I think you're doing far better. Who wants to be retired?
So do I. No, on that subject, I'm in the best place I've ever been. I find it very cathartic now to talk about my mental health. And I've never been so healthy since I've started to be brave and to realise it's okay not to be okay. Mm-hmm. And I realise that you inspire people when you share your vulnerabilities. I do talks now that I, a few years ago, couldn't have dreamt I'd ever be able to do because of fear of panic attacks.
And I think you're a really good example of what we see in many of our guests, where they go through things like this. And in a weird kind of way, it seems to correlate that the longer it took them to come to terms with their own mental illness, the more passionate they are about helping others. Mm. It can teach you to be so empathetic. Going through these kind of experiences makes you kind. And hence, it's no surprise to me that you and loads of our guests have taken these experiences and found a way to turn it into their work, their lifestyle, to inspire others.
Yeah, I, for anyone listening to this podcast, I was nearly 54 years old when I outed myself about my mental health. I just so wish I'd done it so many years earlier, but I didn't have the guts to do it because of the stigma around mental health. But it has changed my life. My life is so much more rich now. Yes, I may not have the money of some of my colleagues who didn't suffer what I suffered from, but I've never felt so rich. I've never felt so healthy. I've never felt so positive about life since I've started talking about my mental health.
And money can be just as lonely as poverty anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
And so in terms of you speaking about it for the first time, what was going through your head? Was there a certain tipping point where you thought, I have to talk about this now?
I wish I had a better story, but I'll tell you the truth. I was working for the company Autotrader, and the HR director knew that I was a qualified mental health counsellor. So I bumped into her in April 2016, and she said to me, David, next month is National Mental Health Awareness Week. You know a bit about mental health, don't you? She said, in the past, we've got speakers in from outside the business to talk about mental health. Why don't you do it? People in the company would love the fact that it's coming from one of her own people. And she only asked me that because she knew I was a qualified mental health counsellor.
Right.
I felt a bit trapped. I felt I had to say yes. And I hoped it would go away. And about a week later, she emailed me and said, can you send me over your slides? I'm really interested to see what you're going to talk about. And I thought, so am I, because what slides? I've got no slides. And then I remember going home that night thinking, I know what I'll do. I'll out myself. I'll share my own mental health story. Now, I knew I was leaving the company 4 months later. So I've often been asked, if I hadn't been leaving Autotrader, would I have still outed myself? And the answer is, I'll never know. We agreed that I do talks to small, intimate groups of people. I wish I'd have checked her interpretation of small, intimate groups of people, because I thought, you know, 5-6 people, but in May 2016 we had rooms of 30 people at a time in Manchester and London when I first talked about my mental health. And I didn't know if I'd be able to do it. I didn't know if I'd have panic attacks. I didn't know if I'd break down. They weren't easy, but I got through them. And of everything I've ever done in my life, nothing has ever touched so many people and quite so deeply that it inspired me to carry on doing it. And I suddenly realized I could do it. And I've been doing talks now and workshops for the last 2.5 years now. And I only discovered in the last 6 months why I can do it. Because when you avoid doing certain talks for 30 years, and then all of a sudden you can do them and speak at big conferences, naturally people say, hang on, are you for real? But I couldn't answer people. I didn't feel I could answer people properly. Why could I suddenly do them? And I realized that in the last 6 months why, and I'll share that with you now. I never thought I'd find a cure. And cure's a really good word, because I'll never be cured. Even outside, before I did this podcast, I thought, I wonder if this is the moment I screw up. I wonder if I'm going to have a panic attack this afternoon. The difference is these days, when I think that, I think to myself, well, screw up. Have a panic attack. Talk to the people on your podcast what it feels like to have one. And by allowing myself to have one, I'm being kind to myself. I'm showing myself compassion. So the reason I can now talk publicly about my mental health without a panic attack is because I've discovered self-compassion. Right. We all think we have to be so perfect in life, and we just don't. As I say, you inspire people when you share your vulnerability. And I just wish I'd discovered self-compassion a lot earlier in my life and being a lot kinder to myself. I've spent 30 years panicking about having a panic attack when the answer was, have one, it's okay. But to really believe that.
And also on the other side of that, for other people, it's only because of the stigma, I think, mainly that's a problem for those observing a panic attack. And actually, I'd rather frame it as an opportunity. So I used to work at Samaritans and various other mental health charities. And so I've been around more panic attacks than I can count. And every time it's easier to be with that person because so much of it is just being there, trying to slow down their thoughts, listen to them, find out what's going on, and it will always pass.
Yeah, very true, very true.
So I'm interested to know from you, in terms of being a counsellor and that as your workplace, have you felt pressure over the years, particularly before you started talking about your own mental illness, to hide that and seem like I'm perfect in this binary way of, oh, I'm not ill, and therefore you can look up to me as your counsellor?
It's a good question. I assumed when I went into counselling that I would be sharing my own battles with panic and anxiety. But the modality of counselling I've chosen is person-centred, which means that in person-centred counselling, my client is the expert. We believe in the theories of Carl Rogers and that by being non-judgmental and being very empathic and being very congruent with somebody, that we can help them to find the answers of how they can get themselves into a better place. So the danger in person-centered counselling, if I shared with somebody one day my own anxiety or panic attacks, we're all unique human beings. And if their panic attacks were nothing like mine, I lose my client at that point because they think you've got no idea what I go through. So none of my clients know that I have battles with mental health, not one of them, because that's my modality. We don't share anything. We don't disclose anything. It's all about our client, because there is a danger of sharing that you could lose somebody in terms of the therapeutic relationship.
Right. And so in terms of other counsellors you've worked alongside, did you feel able to be open always with them?
When I was on my journey to become a counsellor, I still suffered really badly with panic attacks on my course. I found it very difficult to do presentations and talks and things like that. So I didn't really out myself until after I was a counsellor.
Right.
In some ways, becoming a counsellor has equally changed my life, because I've really learned to become true to self, and it has made it easier to talk about things. But it wasn't until after I'd qualified, never really thought about this before, that I outed myself. Many of my fellow counsellors saw clues and perhaps picked up signs that I had some battles with my mental health, but I never talked about it on that course.
It's really interesting, because that's one of the challenges of particularly person-centred counselling, is that you have to understand so much yourself and your triggers, because otherwise it's so easy for you, let's say, like you described with clients talking about panic attacks, if you get distracted by your own thoughts or don't realise some of your own triggers, then you can start panicking about your stuff and not be emotionally there with the client. And then you can sort of misinterpret them because you're focusing on your emotions.
Thinking about yourself, spot on. You're told at the start of the course that this could impact on your personal relationships because you're going to learn a lot about yourself. And you tend to ignore it. You think it goes over your head thinking, yeah. It ended my 28-year marriage because I hadn't really realised I wasn't particularly happy. I realised as the course progressed that I was sitting on the fact that I wasn't really happy in the most, you know, one of the most important relationships of my life. So myself, my ex-wife, we now get on very well. We're both a lot happier than what we were in new relationships. But we both put down my journey to become a counsellor as ending an unhappy marriage. And we think we'd probably still be married if I hadn't have gone on that journey.
Yeah. But then, of course, what's important to note is that you may have actually been hiding from that unhappiness, so you may not have entirely being aware of that. So it's not as simple as counselling and marriage.
No, absolutely.
It's increasing your self-awareness.
Spot on. I didn't realise I was unhappy until I went on the journey and I became far more skilled in my own self-awareness. You're absolutely right.
And so I'd love to talk to you more about counselling, but we're nearly out of time. So in terms of then going back to the workplace and mental health, you now go around the UK teaching organisations how to be better at dealing with mental health and giving talks to employees, is that right?
Interestingly, there's a real split in the camp out there about what mental health in the workplace is.
Right.
And I'll exaggerate a little bit to make my point. It took me 5 years to qualify as a mental health counsellor. You can't send people managers in the workplace on a two-day course and expect them to come back as mini counsellors. It's evidence-based in the workplace that managers won't speak to people about mental health because they don't feel qualified. Mental health in the workplace is not about educating people on mental health. It's about creating kinder, more compassionate cultures. If you're working for me in a corporate environment, the most important thing is that we have a trusting, personable relationship. So if you're in a bad place, you one day feel that you could speak to me. And if you did speak to me and bravely shared with me that you weren't in a great place for your mental health, I don't try and fix you. My job is to make sure you get the right sort of professional help,
right,
and to openly talk to you about that. So education of managers in the workplace, yes, perhaps it helps them a little bit to understand a bit more about mental health. But it's more important to learn the importance of being kind, the importance of actually asking you how your weekend was, checking in with you, to do with stuff outside of work. How would you ever talk to me about your well-being if only I ever engage you is stuff to do with work?
Right.
So it's about creating kinder, more compassionate cultures, not really educating people on mental health.
Yeah, that's such a good point that whilst some education on mental health is good for managers to demystify it and to make it less scary. It's far more important to teach them that when it comes to looking after their employees, it doesn't actually take a huge amount, that actually you asking how their weekend was could be the start of a journey of them recovering.
Every one-to-one meeting should start with, how are you? You know, how was your weekend? How's the family? As opposed to going straight into talk about work. And it's not just asking the question, it's really important to listen back non-judgmentally.
Right.
Because there's nothing worse than asking a question and then not listening.
Yeah, because people learn. They won't be honest again.
It's also important in that education, the language we use. If I was worried about your mental health and I went up to you in the workplace and said, even if we had a great relationship and said to you, I'm really worried about your mental health, you'd find it too invasive. You'd go into shutdown mode. But if I said to you, I've noticed recently a slight dip in your energy levels, you might say, I'm not surprised. I've got this going on at work, this going on at home. I'm not sleeping. I'm not concentrating. You might talk to me about your well-being because I didn't use the words mental health. So we have to be very conscious about the language we use. Every one of us has physical health. And at some stage every year, our physical health could be better. Well, mental health is exactly the same. Everybody has mental health. And at some stage every year, your mental health could be better. People presume that poor mental health is if you're diagnosed with bipolar or schizophrenia or anxiety or depression. If you're not sleeping, if you're really lethargic, if you're struggling to concentrate, all of that is poor mental health as well. It's not one in four, it's one in one. When something becomes one in one, it gets a lot easier to talk about. Because you're not sitting there thinking, I wonder who the one in four is. We've all got mental health. We've all got physical health. To give you an indication how far we have to go, we're all very familiar with Google Images. Mm-hmm. If you put physical health into Google Images, you get pictures of amazing bodies. Yet you didn't put in great physical health. You just put in physical health. If you put mental health into Google Images, you get people pulling their hair out in distress, looking suicidal. Why? They're the same. We've all got health, both physical and mental. Mm-hmm. Why should one image for physical health be so positive and mental health be so negative? In there lies somewhere one of the reasons why we find it difficult to talk about this subject.
That's such a brilliant point. I actually don't have anything to add to it. I just agree entirely. And so we'll wrap up in a moment. Do you want to just talk us through, if people want to learn more about the kind of workshops you give to workplaces, how else you can support workplaces, where they could find out more about that?
My website is www.breakingthesilence.co.uk, and people can contact me via my website. Interestingly, I called my business when I launched it 2.5 years ago, Breaking the Silence, because I broke my silence. But these days when people say, why is your business called Breaking the Silence? I say it's because the stigma of mental health is the silence, the wall of silence that exists around it. We've got to get people talking more openly about mental health and their well-being. And people can also email me on davidbeeney@breakingthesilence.co.uk. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.